All right, everybody, let's get started. We're very pleased to be included in Senator Lisa Murkowski's Parks Highway Town Hall tour that she is on. Thank you guys all for coming. We've got a bit of business to take care of with some of the kids before they go on the bus. Otherwise, the floor will be open and you can ask questions of the senator. Just by way of introduction, Senator Lisa Murkowski is a lifelong Alaskan. She is the first Alaskan-born senator. She's Alaska's senior senator and is the top Republican on the Energy Committee. Please welcome Senator Lisa Murkowski.
Thank you. And with that, would you guys like to give her your stuff?
Ari, I think you're up.
Yep, here you go.
Hi, my name is Arian Burnside in second grade. I like this book about predators because it is very interesting.
Hi, my name is Julia Carbone and I'm in first grade and I like this book, Lola Goes to Work, because it's funny.
It's funny.
Hi, my name is Poppy, and I am in fourth grade, and I like this book called Flying Eagle because of the pictures.
Wow.
Thank you, Senator Murkowski.
Wow. So for those of you who might not know, we have actually been able to supply books to schools throughout the state. And so I think what Ari, Poppy, and Celia have shared with you are some of the books that came to the school from the Library of Congress, where we're able to get surplus books and package them up and send them off to schools throughout the state. So I'm so pleased that you like the books, because they're pretty special once you get into your libraries. So enjoy them, learn lots, read lots, okay? All right, thank you. You're pretty impressive from the first and second graders, so thank you very much. Thanks. Okay, fact of the matter is if you're kids like that, we're gonna be just fine here. So proud of the schools. I just came from the junior, senior high school, and it was my first opportunity to see the school, which, first of all, is just a gorgeous facility. But I will tell you, the kids, you know, they knock your socks off. You all can ask me challenging questions. They won't ask anything like what the younger kids ask. There's no political correctness, and that's a good thing. They've got inquiring, inquisitive minds, and that's exactly what we want to encourage. So you're doing well out here. Whitney, thank you for the opportunity to spend a little bit of time this afternoon. Can you hear me okay in the back? Okay. You mentioned I'm kind of doing my road trip. Started out in Fairbanks to help open the Arctic Winter Games, which, if you're not paying attention to what's happening there in Fairbanks, it's a great gathering of 300-plus Alaskan athletes, and in conjunction with Greenland and Russia and Canada. It's a fabulous sporting and athletic and diplomatic event that's going on in Fairbanks right now. I spent yesterday in Nenana. We had coffee with the folks there, had lunch in Anderson and Clear, dinner in Healy, with the folks there talking about park issues and what's happening with the level of tourism. Got up this morning, had coffee in Cantwell, and lunch here. And after this, I'll be going to Houston and Big Lake. So it's kind of an opportunity for me to just check in with folks along the roads here. I think oftentimes what happens is you get, whether elected officials or just people who have a title attached to their name that might have some level of influence over what happens in our state, and they like to come up in the summertime. And I would venture to say that most of you are busier than usual. You don't have a chance to sit down and visit. So This is my favorite time of the year. I'll find any excuse to be back in Alaska in March. And so I'm pleased to be out on the roads and know that it's just a good time to be here. Lots that is happening in Washington right now. We are just beginning the appropriations process. I think this is actually good for us to have a budget, to have a return to what we would call in the Congress regular order, which is processing of bills, working within a top line budget, but rather than doing continuing resolutions, which I think are a bad way to run a government, much less any of our federal agencies. We are working on these initiatives. We have passed out a couple bills in the past month here. You might not think that that's unusual, but given the very contentious nature and the operations of the Senate in this past year, it is a little bit unusual. We just moved through a child care block development grant program that passed with a very regular order and I think a good product. We've passed through the Senate, now through the House, and then back from the conference committee, a flood insurance bill, significant for us in this state where we're operating off of flood maps that had no rhyme nor reason. So that has been, I think, a significant initiative. We are in the process of dealing with some additional pieces of legislation, but our progress right now, I think, is less than stellar, I'll be honest with you. We're getting into the political season and more focused on politics than we are on policy. Having said that, my purpose is not to speak to you today. It's really to hear from you. I'd like this to be as open a forum as we can make it, and that means giving you time to speak. If you don't have a question, that's fine. Give me a statement. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what you think you need to do. If I need to hear the complaint, I'm happy to take that. And if action is required, or if you just are looking for an update on specific items, I'm happy to field that as well. But it really is your opportunity to give me feedback from your community here in Talkeetna in the region. So with that, if I can just go ahead and open it up to whomever would like to begin the conversation. Yes, sir.
I'm retired military, and I have, when I turned 65, they made me go on Medicare. Right. I mean, it's not a choice. And they also, if I didn't take the Part B, I lose my TRICARE for life. So now I'm paying $100 and some a month for Part B. I've also got Blue Cross of paying $400 and something, and 7% vet, so I have VA if I wanted it. But my point is, first off, I should have been made to be on Medicare. I think, you know, I don't need it. I have Blue Cross, all the rest of it, I just mentioned. And for me, I'm back in 65 and 69 when I re-enlisted, free medical and all after life. I probably heard that to death, so I won't believe that. But happened to have that Medicare, which is a cost to everybody here. And then I've got the additional for me when I'm three times covered without it. And to admit the fact that I would have to lose my TRICARE if I don't get the one, really. And that's the reason I have Blue Cross, is I still get two kids in school. So,
Well, what you're speaking to, and I don't know that this is working anymore, so I'm just going to put it down. I don't need to hold it. But what you're speaking to is part of the problem that we're facing with a system that is, when it was built in the 60s, was probably a rational system. But what has happened now, as we have kind of done overlap on overlap with the Part D that you're talking about. Just the requirements that we have, you don't have flexibility within the system. When you turn 65, it doesn't make any difference, you know, whether you have your own great insurance, whether you are still working for the next 30 years.
and don't need to be covered under Medicare, you don't have that option. It automatically becomes your primary. And your VA, your TRICARE, Blue Cross, nothing. Everything becomes your primary. And when you think about an overloaded system that we currently have with Medicare right now, there are a lot of folks that could use to greater benefit what Medicare has to offer. But because we're kind of taking up that space right now because the system demands it, the system requires it, this is part of the problem. So when we talk about how we deal with our budget issues and the fact that about 56% of our spending right now is on the mandatory side of the ledger. And by mandatory, I mean Medicare, Medicaid, now with the Affordable Care Act, the provisions under that all become mandatory. In other words, there's no act of Congress that follows. It is an automatic payout to individuals just as yourself.
And it's also...
It's not sustainable.
My Blue Cross, because of that, if Medicare says it's not covered, they say, well, Medicare said it's not covered. And it was covered prior to that. So I've actually, my Blue Cross is now less than it was, but I still pay the same amount. And it really just drives me crazy.
Were you one of those policies that when the Affordable Care Act went into play, you lost your coverage through Blue Cross?
No, I still have the Blue Cross, but like I say, I've had a deal where I had to go in, and they says, well, Medicare doesn't fund that, so we don't need it now. I'm going, what? You know, because I've had that same thing going on, some issues I have, medical issues I have, and now it's not covered.
And you would think that with Medicare, TRICARE, and your own private, you'd have all the boxes checked.
What we're dealing with is not a system that is wholly integrated. And when we talk about healthcare reform, and I'd welcome comments from the rest of you, when we talk about healthcare reform, roll it back to the discussions that we had 4 or 5 years ago when we were first talking about what it is that we need to do. In my mind, healthcare reform means decreasing the cost of healthcare and increasing access. We haven't seen increased access yet. We haven't seen decreased costs. In fact, we've seen increased costs in this state. We have not yet reformed healthcare, in my view. So what we have done is we have required people to purchase insurance. But think about it, if we had worked first to try to drive down the cost drivers, bring down the cost drivers in healthcare, and made healthcare more affordable, maybe we all wouldn't need to have this level of insurance. Yes, sir, in the back.
When I got involved with Meals on Wheels, I met a lot of folks who have medical conditions. And it appears that medical treatment and dental treatment in the state of Alaska is almost 25% higher than any state below 48. Folks are going to Seattle, staying at a Marriott for 2 weeks, having surgery, recovering, flying home cheaper than they can have their medical treatment here in the state. Why?
It's a fair question, and I don't know if 25% is accurate, but I can tell you, I know that the state is doing this in terms of encouraging folks to go down to the lower 48 for treatment. I know that some of the labor unions with their plans are looking at this and not only encouraging it, but paying the way down to Seattle for treatment, providing for payments for a hotel room, because it's ultimately cheaper for them under their plan to get the care down there and pay for the cost of transportation and lodging in certain cases. Your question is a fair one. Now we know, hey, fact of matter is it's more expensive to do any kind of business in the state of Alaska. We just know that. It costs more to build a school, it costs more to build a house, it costs more to fill up your car, it just costs more. But that much more? And I think this is where we have some issues trying to reconcile this. Part of the problem is We don't have a lot of providers. We just don't have a lot of providers. When you've got 710,000 or thereabouts people in the whole state, and we don't have a medical school, we're always fighting to get the medical professionals up here. So that's part of our problem. We're not in like the UW Medical Center down there where you've got providers and hospitals on every corner that provide a level of competition that can then bring down costs. That's part of our reality that factors into an already high cost state. So I mean, I have very direct conversations with our folks within the Alaska medical community, and I say, I hear this all the time from folks. Can we really justify those costs? And I have yet to find a doctor who I really think is in it to really benefit his or her personal bottom line. From what I can tell, these are people who really care about the people that they see, but they also care about the people that work for them. And they need to make sure that the receptionist or the young woman who's doing the medical transcription, that they're able to pay their bills too. It's a tough situation for us here in Alaska. I think we need to be looking very critically. How can we ensure that there is there's a greater efficiency with our healthcare costs? I don't think that we have focused on that piece of it yet. We've got some examples here, though. For any of you who have been through South Central's facility down in Anchorage, what they have there is they call it the NUCA model, and it's kind of the they don't call it a medical home concept because that denotes certain things. But what they have done within this effort to reduce their costs and increase patient satisfaction is being viewed as really quite revolutionary within the field. They've got people from different countries that are coming to study this as a model. I think it's something that as Alaskans we should be proud that we're trying to innovate to do more to bring down costs. But I think in our regular structure, I don't want to say that, but in what would be assumed as more the typical standard of delivery here in Alaska, we're not in a good spot. Not in a good spot from the patient's perspective, nor the provider's perspective.
On that note, that's kind of one of the reasons I'm here. I'm a transplant from Pittsburgh. I'm coming from private practice to a community health center. We have a wonderful facility here, Sunshine. And I'm seeing issues with both the recruitment and retention of especially experienced providers like myself. I'm a dentist by trade. And I think that the state has to, instead of looking at, you know, shipping our patients other places, trying to get the practitioners here. And there's really nothing as a true incentive, you know, to bring the talented providers to our state. We need to look at different programs, whether it's federal or state, to, you know, maybe compensate these people, make the pay scale attractive enough that they'll want to stay here for the rest of their careers. I mean, it seems like a lot of the practitioners that do come are, I want to say kids, because I'm in my mid-40s, but our kids are coming out of schools, doing, you know, 2 or 3 years to pay off student loans, and going back to the lower 48. We got to figure out how to retain those practitioners. And, you know, that's something, I don't know if there's a clear-cut answer, but we got to, you know, find a way to do that so we don't have to make trips to Seattle to get the best care.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And if you have what you feel would be helpful ideas to us, I would certainly welcome them. And welcome to you from Pittsburgh. You're really in God's country here, so that's a good thing. But this is so much a part of our problem. And if you talk to folks around the state, whether it's South Central or whether it's Providence in Anchorage, they spend a lot of money to try to get folks to come up here, and we hear it all the time. They come, they're here for a season or two, and decide that this is a long way from relatives, and gosh, it's dark during the winter. And the snow actually stays on the ground for more than a weekend. what are we going to do with this? There's a couple things that I think we as Alaskans can do. I think we need to encourage growing our own to a more fulsome extent. But that's hard to do when you don't have the medical schools. And it's hard to do when you have such a small population. But I think we can do better. Right now, we have 20 spots. That's double than what we had about 5-6 years ago. 20 spots at University of Washington Medical School through the WAMI program. That's kind of our medical school. 20. And there's no guarantee that those 20 come back to Alaska. So when I think about ways that we in this state can do more to attract those in these underserved areas, I'm one that believes as Alaskans we need to invest in ourselves. We got about, well, I was told that a couple weeks ago we surpassed the $50 billion mark in our permanent fund. That's a good nest egg. We used to have a loan forgiveness program for students in this state. I was the beneficiary. In fact, I was just in under the wire in terms of loan forgiveness. It was, as a young student had just graduated, not only with undergraduate debt, but now law school debt, I was looking for two things. I was looking for the place that was gonna pay me as much money as I could quickly so that I could get out from underneath this debt, or I was looking for a place where there would be some forgiveness. So for me, it was a no-brainer. And I don't want to say that as a born and raised third generation Alaskan, I wasn't going to come home, but it made me come home immediately. It made me come home right away because I knew that as soon as the clock started ticking, I was working with the state to pay down that loan. And for a young person coming out, you know, you couldn't even barely rent an apartment anywhere because of what you were paying for your student loans. And it's gotten far more expensive. And from the medical professional, you got these young people that are coming out with $200,000-$300,000 in debt. So I think that that's one thing that the state can be doing that is more aggressive. But I think we also need to worry about the retention side of it, because it's one thing to get the folks here, it's another thing to keep them here. So I'd love to pick your brain on it. Young lady in the front.
I have a question. If the dam is built and there's an earthquake, what would happen? Like, is there any worries about it?
Sure, I'd be worried.
The dam is an issue that I'd be curious to hear a little more feedback from you folks on. Obviously, a mega project. Mega in the sense of dollars, but mega in the sense of energy generation, and really from an environmental perspective, a mega project. This is a project that has been under study for decades now, but I think it's also very important to recognize that while the studies may exist out there, it's important to make sure that we truly understand not only the environmental issues, but you bring up a point. If there are permits that are issued for a dam, we are in an earthquake-prone state, an earthquake-prone area. Can a dam even be built that can withhold the types of earthquakes that we see? We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of North America's largest earthquake. So these are important questions that need to be asked. I understand in this area, and I don't mean to make suggestions for the community, but my understanding is that most in this area do not support Suzette Nwatana. Is that, I'm seeing an affirmative head nodding here.
Yeah, we actually had an advisory vote with the community council, and it was 109 to 19. So 109 opposed.
So overwhelming. Overwhelming. And again, I am one who, as Whitney noted in my introduction, I focus on energy just about 365 days a year with my position on the Energy Committee, and knowing that energy is probably the number one subject of discussion in the state as people who are surrounded by an abundance of energy experience real energy poverty and insecurity in many, many ways because of the high cost of energy. So how do we do this? How do we make sure that our communities are sustainable because we've got reliable, affordable, clean, diverse, secure supplies of energy without the concerns that I think are expressed in this town? We've got a couple things going on, probably more than a couple things. You've got a gas line that we're talking about. That's a mega project. That's $55 to $65 billion. A Watana would be a multi-billion dollar project. Both of these kind of serve the same customer base, if you will, in terms of the rail belt. Both would provide more than the constituent base. So I think it's important that we as Alaskans look at this critically. You can't, I suppose you can, have two mega projects going forward at once. I don't know that as a state we're capable of doing that. I don't know that it's wise that we do that. So we need to be considered in how we approach whether it's a major hydro project like Susitna Watana. I have long been advocating a way to move our natural gas resources from the slope to benefit Alaskans, but also to benefit others for export, that I just think is wise and important for us. So we've got some decisions that are made. The governor has kind of pulled back in terms of his budget going forward, but I think we need to be very considered in our approach to how we advance these very serious energy projects.
Our community is full of people who really believe in things like renewable energy and live by it and live off the grid and live with solar panels and live with windmills, and we really are energy conscious. Many of us have taken advantage of the wonderful state program for home energy rebate and weatherization. Fabulous. What great results that brings. So we find ourselves in this kind of awkward position of seeming to be against renewable energy because many see large hydro as renewable. But we've had some good luck recently in finding some others who don't see large hydro as renewable. And one group that doesn't is U.S. Congress, we found out. Because, you know, in January, the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2014 was passed, and I'm sure you are well aware of it because you voted for it. It says, the Secretary of the Treasury shall instruct the United States Executive Director of each international financial institution that it is the policy of the United States to oppose any loan, grant, strategy, or policy of such institution to support the construction of any large hydroelectric dam as defined in Dams and Development, a new framework for decision making. And according to the World Commission on Dams, a large dam is one with a height of 15 meters or more at the foundation. And the Susitna Watana Dam is supposed to be more, I mean, that's 15 meters is 50 feet high. This one is 735 feet high for starters. And it's a mega dam. It's a huge project. And many states, I think over half of them that have renewable standard portfolios, also do not consider a dam of this size to be renewable. Most of them are 50 or fewer megawatts. That's how they. And recently, in fact, just today, we found about an article that was done by an Oxford group. It just came out, so I don't know if you have it, but I'm going to give you a copy of it, that looked into large hydro, and it's called Should We Build More Large Dams? The Actual Cost of Hydropower Mega Project Development. And they took a very systematic look at large hydro around the world and concluded that because it's there of cost overruns, I should just read here what it says. Based on, we find overwhelming evidence that budgets are systematically biased below actual costs of large hydropower dams, excluding inflation, substantial debt servicing, environmental, and social costs. And the outside view we have taken suggests that in most countries, large hydropower will be too costly in absolute terms and take too long to build, and to deliver a positive risk-adjusted return unless suitable risk measures outlined in this paper can affordably be provided. Policymakers are advised to prefer agile energy alternatives that can be built over shorter time horizons than to energy, shorter time horizons to energy mega projects. So we're starting to find some support for our small little town's view that this big dam is not renewable. I know you're a supporter of hydro. I think a lot of us are too. I think hydro is one of the coolest, you know, look at what's happening in Southeast. I grew up in Washington State where some hydro is good and some's not so good. I think it can be done well. I think it can be considered renewable, and I'm all for it. But if it's big, it's not. It has too many impacts on other valuable renewable resources. And I don't have to tell you about them, the salmon and wildlife and other economies. So I wonder how you can help us, because you got the handle out. You're one of the top Republicans in the Energy Committee. So how can you help us?
Well, this is an issue that is really kind of near and dear to me, because as you, I've got roots in Southeast. So I grew up in a part of the state where it's where we got our energy was through hydro, but it's small hydro. It's small hydro. It's lake tap hydro. It's hydro that you barely even know is there. What you do know is there are transmission lines. You got to be able to move the power, and that's where people make the connection. Okay, I guess that's where my lights are coming on. And the struggle that I've had in Washington, D.C. is I go back there to Washington and they say, well, hydro is not a renewable energy source. And I say, well, you apparently weren't born in Ketchikan, Alaska, where it rains, you know, hundreds of inches a year, and it's a pretty sustainable resource there. But what people conceive of in the lower 48, when they think of hydro, for most people in the lower 48, I think they do believe it's the Hoover Dam, it's the Tennessee Valley Authority, it's the Bonneville Power, it is the mega dams. And so they look at that and say, well, that doesn't look renewable to me. What they don't appreciate is that hydro can be such a diverse energy source. In these hydro bills that we just passed, the first energy bills of the Congress, two hydro bills, you know, we're talking about generating power from irrigation ditches, using the power of water that way. Pretty fundamental, basic little stuff that in terms of your environmental impact, almost negligible, and really a way that we can just use smarts and ingenuity to access water in a way that makes sense. So as I fight to enlarge the definition of renewable to include hydro, I'm coming at it from my perspective as an Alaskan, where we have run-of-river hydro, where we have lake tap hydro, that is a very, very different definition. And I've worked with the American Rivers Group, who they know full well the difference between what you have in the lower 48 and are working with us to get the Blue Lake Hydro Project in Sitka advanced, because they know that you can really help a community like Sitka with that renewable energy source right there and not have that environmental impact. So we're talking definitions here, and the fact of the matter is we haven't had a big hydro project built in this country in decades. And because of permitting issues, and I think, you know, there's no way you can get to a proposal like Susitna Watana without miles high of permits to even get to the point where you could have a real discussion about what this project looks like. So I'm not saying that Susitna and the area that we're talking about could not be a prospect for us from a hydro perspective. I need to spend more time with the study of that, but I'm very cognizant that when you view a project that is so big, too big, this is what stopped this in the 80s. It was the cost, most certainly, but it was also the fact that you got too much power here. Now that's kind of an inconceivable thought for many people in the lower 48. But you've got too much here, and then what do you do with it? So I think we've got to be cognizant of some of the issues that we face here. And when I say we as a state need to look at this very critically, we need to make sure that we're making good, sound energy decisions, but instead of spending, you know, several hundred thousand dollars here and a couple million dollars over there studying all this, maybe we need to do a more holistic view of how can we best advantage our energy resources for the benefit of Alaskans without kind of the proverbial overkill. So I'm going to continue to push hydro in the country from the perspective of what we have been able to see that benefits us as Alaskans, where you're able to access a renewable resource and you're able to do it in incremental ways that make sense for your area. So I hope that you do have a copy that you can share with me on that. These are important energy issues. But again, trying to build something that we will never be able to utilize is something that we got to be talking about.
I know there's some questions about the financing too. And somebody who's maybe Whitney, could you address that?
Sure. Just recently, the project manager announced.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Just recently, we had been following for a while that the project had been approaching the USDA Rural Utility Service grants for funding, potential funding for the project. And we got somewhat of a confirmation. I mean, there's a lot of legalities and they need to follow NEPA and, like you said, a lot of permitting. But it's of a concern to us that the state sort of sold the initial project as being not federally funded and now apparently is looking for almost half of the project cost to be covered by what's considered by most to be a rural utility service when we're servicing both of our most urban areas in the state. So at this point, I think the number is maybe half, $3 billion could be financed by a federal program. And we're just wondering if you have any insight on that.
Well, let me tell you, we turn to the USDA for a lot of assistance in this state for smaller projects. And if I thought that there was $3 billion for one single project in the state.
Yeah. I know the whole fund is $6 billion,
yeah,
so that would be about
half.
That's not
in the realm of reason in terms of what is within USDA's budget and ability right now. So to suggest that you're going to get that much from the federal government, keep in mind also that, you know, we've changed the landscape dramatically in the Congress when it comes to earmarks. This is not a day and an age where we can say, okay, we want to put our muscle behind a Wautana or a natural gas pipeline. Those, first of all, the funds are not there in a tight budget environment. And second of all, we don't have the opportunity to earmark. Third, USDA, again, is a great friend to us in Alaska on many, many projects. But the size and scope of what you're talking about, I think, is beyond reach and quite possibly beyond imagination right now. And another thing that you need to be aware of, and this is a role that I'm playing right now, there are land conveyance issues that are still in play with the area that we're discussing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like the first place to start is to make sure that you can even access this, and that has not been resolved. So, and believe me, because this is an area in my wheelhouse in the Energy Committee. This is, we're in charge of the of public lands and moving legislation that provides for land conveyances. I've been working to get a land conveyance bill through the Senate now for about 5 years or so. There's no flip, there's no switch that is flipped that allows for speedy conveyances. So there's a lot of preliminary stuff that that the state must engage in before you really get to a point where you're asking USDA for even a nickel. You've had your hand up for a while.
There's another project, another place we could get power that could replace the Susitna Dam that I don't think many people are aware of. It's over at Mount Susitna, there's a lake, I think it's called Minchumina.
Yeah, and
that would be the Lake Tap source, and we could tie into the Beluga infrastructure and get it over here. Mm-hmm. And it just seems, from what I have heard, that would be less intrusive and perhaps even far more useful to the state than building a dam that everyone fears and the locals are very much against. And you don't hear about that possibility. All you hear about is the Susitna Dam.
When I was in Cantwell this morning, so you know, just on the other side of the park here, what they're talking about there is a small hydro project that would come off Jack River.
Mm-hmm.
Estimated between 5 and 10 megawatts, and you know, again, helping to round out the energy needs within this rail belt area. Is it the end all and be all of energy in production on the rail belt? No, but does it help? And again, in a more incremental way, where you're kind of doing what you do in Southeast, which is you feed in different parts of the region into your grid. There's a couple things that we have in this state that are kind of teed up to do just these kinds of assessments. Through the Alaska Energy Authority, they did a state energy assessment. It was maybe 2 years, maybe it was even 3 years ago. It might have been as much as that. But trying to do kind of, you know, the energy atlas of the state. What is our potential? Our potential is enormous between what we have with our hydro resources. You've got geothermal. You clearly have things like your wind and your solar, your intermittent. You've got your traditional fuel sources, whether it's coal, oil, natural gas. You know, we truly are a state that has it all. And I think that's almost been part of our problems. It's like we don't even know where to start. And so we're kind of throwing the dart at all parts of the board here instead of focusing in on some of the initiatives that we can afford and that will work to meet our needs plus give us a little extra room for growth, which is what we have to have. So how we can work to facilitate a level of studies that gets us somewhere rather than just yet one more study that is added into the box of things that we've already taken a look at. This is part of our challenge.
That kind of like a survey of the different kinds of power. But why would they be so adamant that, oh, this is the only way we're going? Because they've been very reluctant to take any suggestions that they need, maybe putting their eggs in more than one basket.
Well, and I don't mean to kind of pass the buck here, but that really is a question of the state administration right now, because they have directed up to this budget year. They've put a lot of money towards kind of re-upping Susitna Watana, and you know, that's a decision that comes out of the state administration. I'm kind of looking at it from the perspective of, okay, what's the federal role here? And as I say, the federal piece on Susitna right now is it possible, how can any conveyances be made that would allow for a project like this to go forward? And then when it gets to the permitting process through FERC, that's where there's more of a federal role. But if the state is assigning this as its big energy priority, I think this is where you as community are speaking up. You're doing it to me, and that's important. Yes, ma'am.
Colleagues, I want to thank you so much for coming up to our community and having this intimate space to hear your voices in person. So thank you for making the trip. I like how you talked earlier about, looking back and looking forward. And I hope that, in 5 years from now, that we can look at this dam issue and that the decisions that have been made, and with your help and your insight and energy, that we really, find the right decisions and the right choices in alternative energies. And I hope that you can come back in 5 years from now, that the community can be a lot more at rest, that the decisions are made to use alternative resources.
Well, again, we are blessed with an abundance of resources. And what I think, oftentimes we're held back because we've got regulations, we've got requirements that interfere. And I can help on that end, but I also think that sometimes all we need is just our own imagination and ingenuity. And we see that demonstrated, whether it's small businesses that have decided, hey, I'm going to try to be as energy self-sufficient as I possibly can. And you see it in different pockets across the state, where individuals are just kind of taking charge and saying, we can make our community a little more independent, a little more low cost, and a little more just environmentally friendly. And we see good decisions that are being made. I'm trying to get other folks that haven't spoke up. Yes.
I totally understand if it goes back to the dam. I know it's an important issue. I had a question about health insurance. Uh-huh. Back to that. I would like to know what the federal government will do for folks who have been, because the state of Alaska doesn't have its own marketplace, many people who have applied to the federal marketplace have been kicked to be forced to apply for Alaska Medicaid. And the timing may make it, because the state is so overwhelmed with applications for Medicaid for people that may fall into that gap or may qualify for the Affordable Care Act insurance, the state may not be able to complete people's application process by March 31st. I've spoken with Health and Human Services, and they're super friendly and helpful. They have tons of people on staff, but their response has been way, way bigger than they expected, which means the demand is there, and health insurance is important for many, many people in the state that don't have it or can't otherwise afford it. So what will happen if March 31st comes around and the state of Alaska hasn't gotten back to people with a response, with a denial letter, and then the process is cut off to apply to the federal market?
And I don't know, in terms of the Medicaid deadline with the state. What was happening was, you are required, or were required, to have purchased your health care insurance by March 31. What happened last week was the administration has made a decision. This was actually, I haven't seen this reported in the Alaska press. I'm reading an article from the Wall Street Journal. But there was a technical bulletin that came out last week, and in a footnote, it mentions that the requirement for individuals to purchase has been extended for 2 more years. So what you have to do in order to get this extension is you have to qualify as a hardship, quote. So under that hardship, it's either people under age 30 or a mandate exemption, and those exemptions turn out to be, you know, if you've had a situation in the home with domestic violence, eviction, bankruptcy. But what this is basically laying forward is that pretty much if you have not filed for health care insurance, you're not going to be assessed the fine if you can fill out a piece of paper that says there was a hardship. Now, so that's the federal piece of it. I don't know what this then does to the state's requirement on the Medicaid side.
Well, the state's doing what they can. I mean,
right.
There's thousands and thousands and thousands of Alaskans that don't have insurance.
Exactly.
And that are somewhere in that gray zone between, you know, what they need to do to get the federal subsidy and whether or not they'll qualify for state Medicaid at the top end or whether they're in between. And I mean, I guess the point is obviously there's a big need to continue to work through the process and make sure that Alaskans are getting health insurance if they need it.
And this is what I'm not sure of, is because the federal government, the administration, has now allowed for an extension through a waiver process to the requirement. If that then gives the state then the ability to push out that deadline, which to this point in time has been March 31. And to be very honest with you, I was reading this as I came up on the plane on Friday, and I've been on the road, so I have not checked in with MyHealth LA to find out, okay, how does this knit together? Because I don't know. What I do know is that we've seen some 30 different extensions or waivers of the law that, you know, people expect me as your representative back in Washington to know and understand all aspects of what's coming out with this law. But it has been, in terms of how it has been implemented and then what has been pushed back, I'm not quite sure what's in place right now. It's been extraordinarily, extraordinarily frustrated. Me and my family were kicked off the plan as federal employees, as are people that work for me, and required to purchase on the exchange. I'm a pretty even-keeled person, and by the time I got off of my 3.5 hour wait and discussion with automated voices on the phone, I was using language that my mom wouldn't approve of. It was just horrible. And now, you know, I'm not complaining. I am complaining. I'm paying 2.5 times more than I was, and I'm getting such lousy coverage compared to what I had. And granted, the federal employee benefits plan was a good plan, but everybody else can stay on it. Don't get me going. Let's go over here. And then I'll come back to you, sir.
My family is made up of generations of merchant mariners, and we depend on U.S. flag shipping for our livelihood. Right now, there's talk in Alaska about doing away with the Jones Act. The Jones Act provides over 500,000 shipping jobs, as well as over $100 billion in economic output in this country. And right now Alaska is talking about doing away with that, with the Jones Act. I'm wondering where you stand on that.
Well, because the Jones Act is a federal act, it could not be something that the state says we're going to get rid of the Jones Act. It is something that would have to be done at the congressional level. It's an act that's been around for 100 years and I think built on just good solid foundation of, you know, we need to to encourage that shipbuilding market within this country. We need to encourage crews that are U.S. crews. This is just good business for our country. So I think the principles upon which it was based were sound. There have been instances where it has been difficult to meet the requirements of the Jones Act because you simply don't have ships that are capable, that are not being built to meet a demand now. And we saw this in, after Hurricane Katrina, where they needed to get a certain type of vessel to move certain things, that we just didn't have a U.S. Flagged vessel. And so there was an exemption that was granted through a temporary kind of one-term permit to grant exemptions to the Jones Act. Where the Jones Act is coming up more in discussion now is as it relates to the debate that's going on in Congress about export of our energy, whether it's natural gas or ultimately the potential for oil, because that will be an opportunity where we move a U.S. product coming off of our shores. And the reality is, whether you're talking oil tankers or LNG tankers, we simply, our ability to build those ships, to get them in the water, is limited right now. So there is discussion that is just now beginning to percolate about, well, let's talk about the Jones Act. But it is a debate that I think is only just now beginning. In Alaska, we have seen for decades, seen the benefit of what the Jones Act delivers to us in terms of ensuring that we've got double-hulled vessels in our waters, U.S. crews that, quite honestly, we're very proud of. So this is something that I think you're going to see a lot more in play, in discussion, in the years going forward. But I think for right now, the message is Jones Act is in place and probably will be for the indefinite future, is my guess. Okay, I've got time for one more. All right, I got to go to my friend in the back because he's been so persistent.
What would hurt if the permanent fund built a refinery in our state, for our state, instead of investing where it is now, build a refinery, and gasoline and heating oil would drop 50% for us, or anyone that comes to our state? We have the natural resources. Why don't we have it?
And it's a discussion that has been had, particularly in view of the announced closure of Flint Hills up in the North Pole area, the impact that would have on jobs and the economy, and what we're doing in terms of refined products. We've got a state constitution that pretty much says the natural resources of this state will be used for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans. So there is an issue there that if we take oil from the North Slope and we put it in our, it wouldn't be wrong or it wouldn't be unprincipled for the state to have a refinery. We had a barley project. We had the grain terminals. We have invested, ADA, of course, has invested in many state projects. But where the issue really is taking that oil and then utilizing it for the benefit of, say, the people of the interior or the people of Talkeetna, but not for the benefit of all Alaskans. So this is an issue that has been discussed, and it has had some play in, I think, the administration's determination or decision as to what, if anything, they are able to do with Flint Hills. This whole concept of taking the state's royalty share of the oil and then using that to help reduce the prices of gas to Alaskans in the interior is one that has been discussed and I think rejected on grounds that it would be a violation of our Constitution.
Even though we have 700,000 people and over 400,000 of them live in a poor area, we can still supply the whole state, even if they're not willing to live.
Well, you'd pretty much have to say then that nothing, that everything that goes to Alaskans for consumption, that it would be spread evenly throughout the state, so that you wouldn't have stuff that is coming in from, say, Washington State refineries and coming to Southeastern. You'd have that going on for the people in Southeast, and they'd be paying a different price versus what the people of the interior would be able to benefit because they are in closer proximity to that refinery. You know, we've got so much as a state when you think about our opportunities. Sometimes I think we need to be a little bit more creative with how we are approaching our issues. We kind of go down the same path and, well, we'll study this or we'll study that. But I am very encouraged by what I see when I kind of get off the grid. When I go to some of these smaller communities that have had to be pretty independent, they've had to figure out how they get a level of health care to an area where they're never going to see a doctor who's there full time. And they're utilizing, you know, telehealth and telemental health to help the people there, how we deliver education in areas where we're never going to have a physics teacher for these kids, and how we can work to provide them with opportunities in areas where we've been turning on the lights and keeping houses warm because we're burning diesel. They're coming up with innovative new ideas, how we're using marine hydrokinetic energy through the power of the river in the Yukon, and what we're doing with our biofuels and harvesting the old standing dead growth there and turning it into great wood pellets in the Delta and the Tok area, and then you go out and you look at Chena Hot Springs, and what one guy with a dream who doesn't know the meaning of the word no has turned a resort into an almost 100% energy independent little microcosm there through low temperature geothermal. And, you know, I keep saying we've got 33,000 miles of coastline. Why we're not harnessing the power of the tides in a way that should power every little coastal community. All these little fish processors that can't even afford to make ice because their power is generated by diesel. You go down to Yakutat, great little community, and the boats are going past them. They're not stopping for fuel, they're not stopping for ice because it's just too expensive in Yakutat. And they'll go straight on up. And they'll go to Cordova, where Cordova has a little hydro facility. Their utilities are just a little bit cheaper. They can afford to make ice. Think about it. And so Yakutat is working with some folks on a wave energy project. You know, these are the types of things that really get me excited about, because we've got the potential there. Yeah. And we can do it, and we can be the lead, not only in the country, we can be the lead in the world. If you can make these kinds of projects pencil out in a state where our energy costs are the highest in the nation, you can prove that they can work. So this is what I challenge the kids when I go into the schools. It's like, you guys, you can be the Imagineers. Make it all happen. This is cool stuff. And this is what will make our communities sustainable. So it's all good.